I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Forty percent of Kansas City area residents have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. But despite this good news, coronavirus case numbers have seen a slight bump up. Today, we'll ask the question, is now the time to loosen our pandemic safety measures? The director of the Kansas City Health Department will give us his take and the latest pandemic updates. Then, Mother's Day is approaching, and for many it means flowers, cards, and the kids cooking breakfast. But for some women, it means finding their identity through a mother's recipe. For others, no celebration is needed when you've chosen to be child-free. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City has loosened its rules governing COVID-19 in public places. That means that bars and restaurants are no longer under restricted operating hours, and distancing is no longer required in their establishments. Masks are also no longer required for indoor gatherings with those who are vaccinated. Though Kansas City is continuing to receive vaccinations, are we in the clear to loosen these restrictions? With us to answer that question and more is Dr. Rex Archer. He's the director of the Kansas City Health Department. Rex, it's always good to have you. Welcome.
Well, good morning, and thank you for covering this important topic.
Why are we relaxing rules, Rex, when only maybe a third of Kansas Cityans have gotten started on the vaccination process?
So there is a difference between rules, mandates that we enforce, and guidance. We're still supporting CDC's guidance, but when we are part of a bi-state metro area with, 2.2 million folks, many who don't stay just within their jurisdiction, they may work, play, shop, et cetera, across these lines. It is in some ways unfair and unhealthy for our residents to not have jobs because we're restricting certain activities here that are open across the state line. So we have to balance this, unfortunately, in many ways, because we don't have national requirements that can just mandate through everybody. It would be nice if OSHA actually would mandate some of these things.
Are we taking a risk here, Rex?
There are always risks. I think the difference is that when the general public, there's never enough enforcement, whether it's for speeding on the roads or public health measures, other public health measures, to mandate or enforce something that many of the folks are going to ignore.
Is there any enforcement out there?
Yes, we enforce, which we've been, I think, the strongest jurisdiction, and part of the reason that our death rates are lower than most of the other jurisdictions, not only in the metro area, but across the Midwest, is because we have been enforcing the mandates that we have. But at this point, and we will continue to enforce mandates on indoor mask wearing, with the exception where everybody in that airspace is known to have been fully vaccinated. And so the risk is still there. People need to understand that vaccines prevent death and hospitalizations for COVID, but they do not 100% prevent mild infections that then can spread to others. But if everybody else in that group is protected against those severe issues, then it's really not any more dangerous than the flu in normal years. When we have a particularly bad flu, that's a different situation. But a normal seasonal flu, we don't restrict those activities then.
Rex, to what extent are these new rules just an acknowledgement that people aren't going to abide by strict rules any longer anyways?
Well, a lot of people are going to abide by these, even though they're not rules anymore. So as an example, if you're concerned, you've got medical conditions, you may have been vaccinated, but let's say not everybody yet in your household or your circle has been vaccinated, you may choose to still be careful and wear masks and avoid these settings because you don't want to be the one that asymptomatically spreads it to somebody else that hasn't been vaccinated. There is a point, though, where how much can we restrict individual behaviors when those folks have done the right thing and it's others that haven't been vaccinated yet, haven't taken personal responsibility to protect themselves and others? And how far can we go in restricting folks that have taken personal responsibility for those that haven't? I was definitely against loosening these restrictions until full access to vaccination was available to everybody over 16. But we also need to remember, we still have folks under 16 that don't have access to vaccines yet. Fortunately, the death rates and hospitalization rates are much lower for that group.
Rex, what about this notion that these rules, I know the mayor and I believe yourself started out in the pandemic trying to get a coordinated set of rules across the metro so that the rules would be clear and easily understood. But even as somebody who covers this for a living, I was talking about this on Week in Review, the KCPT program this week. There are so many different rules now in different jurisdictions that I can't keep straight what's in place and what's not in place. What about that part of this?
It clearly is more effective communication when all the jurisdictions are very close to, or if not the same, requirements.
And you guys tried to start out with everyone being on the same page, right?
Well, what I also want to say is that the guidance, the recommendations of the different health departments and the CDC, now that it's no longer gagged by the previous administration, that recommendations are pretty much the same across the jurisdiction. The difference is how far are folks going to go in regards to enforcement and mandates. Those are the differences. Yes, we were the first place to basically shut down back last year because we could see what was happening other places that didn't shut down early. We actually didn't have any confirmed cases yet. But because of that, our first wave was one of the lightest of any jurisdiction around the country. Mm-hmm. So, and we were the first in the bi-state region to put a mask order in place and saved a lot of lives through that and through enforcing it.
Rex, let's run down what these new rules are so everyone understands where Kansas City, Missouri is. What about masks? What are you saying about those, just briefly?
So we used to require masks outdoors also if you were too close to other folks. The data is very clear that except for with some of these new variants that are a little more contagious, we just weren't seeing spread outdoors. And so we've reduced or basically eliminated the requirement to wear masks outdoors. Now, there are some venues like Major League Baseball where the league itself is still mandating that. And we'll kind of see how that evolves or develops. The other thing is that by reducing the mandate for outdoors, we're also then sending the signal, but we're not doing that indoors for folks that aren't vaccinated. So it's a way of reinforcing that the indoor mask is still extremely critical in grocery stores or any place that you can't guarantee that everybody has been vaccinated. So, you know, if you're in a business and you are paying your employees to get vaccinated or at least giving them time off to go get vaccinated, and you know everybody that's going to be in that conference room or office area has been vaccinated, then folks don't need to wear masks anymore. Hmm. But that's the only exception on the indoor space.
How about operating hours for bars and restaurants? Are they back to normal now? Do tables still have to be distance, or where are we there?
Yeah, they are back to normal operating hours, but yes, they still are needing to social distance between those. And we are strongly encouraging that all of the waiting staff and folks that could be exposed to others that are eating and drinking, because obviously when you're eating and drinking, you've removed your mask, and unless you are mandated folks to be vaccinated to be customers at your location. And we're seeing some of that across the nation, and I anticipate we will continue to see that some venues will say, well, we're going to go up to 100% capacity just by simply mandating that people are vaccinated, and then they don't have to wear masks at all.
Dr. Rex Archer is my guest. He's director of the Kansas City Health Department. Our phone number here, if you have questions for Dr. Archer, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Andrea from Miriam on the Kansas side. Andrea, good morning.
Hey, good morning. So I live in Johnson County, Kansas, and Johnson County, Kansas seems to only understand money. So when I saw that they were going to let our mandate expire, I'm like, you know what? I mean, I have an 8-year-old kid, so I can't have him vaccinated. I'm vaccinated. I'm also a healthcare provider. And I just decided, you know, I'm just going to spend my money in the places that are still having mandates. So I'm not going to do shopping in Johnson County.
Hmm. Are you seeing any more of that kind of activity, this rejection of Johnson County's reaction to the COVID, Rex?
I've not specifically discussed that with the public health leadership in Johnson County. But, I mean, for years, and certainly this last year of COVID, folks have decided to, you know, spend their money where they think folks are doing the right thing. So it would not surprise me that there's some of that. You know, until we had vaccines to protect the high-risk folks over 65, et cetera, I strongly recommended that they not go out to restaurants even when they were at a lower seating capacity, like 25%, because there still was evidence of air spread in some cases, you know, 20, 30 feet from wherever somebody might be seated. So, you know, I do see some of that, but we've not done any survey data to determine how widespread it is. But I'm glad the caller at least is holding folks accountable or looking at, well, where am I protected and where is my child being protected and cared for? And therefore, they're taking that risk into account when they make decisions.
What do you make of the fact that we are at a 33% vaccination rate to this point in Kansas City, Rex?
Well, we've made some huge progress. And that, remember, that 33% is a overall, including those that are under 16 that can't be vaccinated yet.
Okay.
So it's actually higher. In Kansas City, Missouri, we're up around 45% for those that are eligible to be vaccinated now, but we're about 75% for those over 65, which is huge. And that's why our death rates have dropped substantially. Now, we're still having deaths, and we are seeing a surge again of hospitalizations, particularly in younger folks that haven't been vaccinated. And I, you know, this issue of, you know, I either don't want to be bothered or I'm hesitant or I'm fearful in some way about getting vaccinated. We had three people who've already died that are in their 20s from COVID in Kansas City, Missouri alone. You know, I've had 30 folks die that were under 50. So people need to get protected for themselves as well as for their family members.
Are you seeing a decline in the number of people who want to get vaccinated, Rex?
Well, you would anticipate that as more people get vaccinated, there's less people that still want to be. So yeah, I would anticipate a decline. I think this surge in hospitalization may wake some folks up that were thinking, well, maybe I don't have to, I'm busy, I work hard. Am I going to run over and get vaccinated when I've got all these other things that I've got to do? We're trying to make this easier and easier. You can walk in so many places now and get vaccinated often in less than 30 minutes. So, it's becoming easier. There are folks that are fearful. I think the J&J being put on hold for a while as we are investigating that. But it's important for people to do the math and the numbers. It took, 7 million doses of J&J before we started to see a very rare potential side effect that is treatable. And now that the physician community knows that might be associated with J&J, they're watching that much more carefully. But, the death rate still from COVID in young folks is much, much higher than any risk of a vaccine.
I'm visiting with Dr. Rex Archer, director of the Kansas City Health Department. There's so much interest out there right now, Rex, and whether we'll get to herd immunity or not. A lot of experts now saying we're not going to get there. The New York Times has a top of the website story about that this morning. Where do you stand on this? How confident are you that we're going to reach it? Or are you losing a little hope here?
So I look at this a little differently than some folks do. There is no magical, at this point, we cross over and we have herd immunity. And when we had five less people vaccinated, we didn't. This is a continuum. We already have some level of herd or population immunity right now. Between the number of people that have been vaccinated and the folks that have gotten the disease. Although what's interesting is that it looks like the vaccines protect people more from reinfection or from another infection from COVID than actually having had COVID itself. So even if you have had COVID and had that virus, you still need to be vaccinated because it protects you better from a re-exposure down the road. So, and I anticipate that eventually our annual flu shot will probably include the COVID shot at the same time, so you can get both each year, because these RNA viruses mutate and change, and we have to probably re-vaccinate at times to protect folks. But we already have less explosive spread because of the number of folks that have been vaccinated, particularly in long-term care facilities, which is where we saw some of the highest death rates in the beginning. A lot of our folks that are over 65, we've already almost reached herd immunity with those folks.
But the concern among some experts, and this, is that the virus is going to sort of linger for years. It'll pop up in some places, decline in others, and it's going to be with us for far longer than it maybe otherwise would need to be if more people got vaccines.
The opportunity to have eradicated or eliminated this virus from spreading in humans is unfortunately past, you're correct. In the same way that influenza, and we have some level of herd immunity from influenza between vaccines each year and folks that have had a similar influenza over the last few years. And that's why influenza doesn't spread quite as rapidly as it does when it mutates a little bit more. But if the 1918 pandemic virus resurfaces, or something, one of the ones that we have now mutates into something similar, we could easily have a much greater pandemic with many times more deaths worldwide and in the U.S. than what we've had with COVID. And that, I think that's probably one of the take homes that the audience needs to understand is, you know, we spend 100 times plus the amount of money in our Department of Defense than we do in what I would call the Department of Biodefense, which is the CDC. Mm-hmm. And yet our risk of death in this country is much higher from natural or and or intentional use of biological agents than it is from any military attack. And so we are flat underprepared. We're underprepared for this pandemic. We still don't have the data systems and the infrastructures. You know, if you'd asked me about what about people that aren't getting vaccinated that are in minority groups or others, and the problem is that our state data systems were not designed to even capture that data, and we haven't required the private sector to report it.
Let's go back to some calls. Gail from Baser. Gail, you're on with Dr. Rex Archer. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. My first thought this morning when I heard the topic was, if Darwin were alive today, he'd be smiling. Survival of the fittest also includes survival of the smartest, and that includes wearing masks for a very long time. That's it.
Gail, thank you for the call. Does she have a point, Rex?
I am very concerned that some folks that are not as aware of the science and have listened to folks that basically like to make money by spreading false issues and rumors and stirring up divisiveness, that those folks are under vaccinating and are at higher risk now of death and disability. So reaching out to folks that have unfortunately been listening to the wrong folks is a challenge. And that I don't have full answers for that. I do think that there's different communication styles. And what's interesting is that even though some of those folks are the very ones that are saying don't get vaccinated and all these problems, and you know, I think they did a study and found that there were 12 individuals that were responsible for the vast majority of the negative views of this vaccine circulating out there, and they just keep recirculating, and then the Russian bots are trying to create divisiveness in this country and not allow us to protect our own citizens. So, yeah, it's a challenge right now of getting those folks to realize that, you know, you're not giving up personal individual liberty by getting vaccinated. Actually, by you're doing your citizen duty and public duty to help us return to more normal operations in a safer way faster.
Rex, is there any reason to think that another pandemic could be just around the corner?
Oh, absolutely. Several of these variants, fortunately, haven't been as transmissible as a couple of them. One of the big ones that's kind of taken over in Kansas City is still well handled by the vaccines. But there are a few variants out there that may challenge our vaccines. Fortunately, they've not been as contagious, so they haven't actually displaced others for very long in very many settings. But we are, you know, we could already have the next major 1918-19 flu pandemic starting on a pig farm in Missouri that could be getting out of control, and we don't even know it yet because we have let our public health lab system across the country and our states fall apart. And unfortunately, in many of the states, the federal dollars that are even available to rebuild the public health lab system aren't being spent. You know, so we're not preparing for that next outbreak. And those countries that learned from the SARS epidemic in 2003 and 4, they did much better than we did here in this country during this pandemic, mm-hmm. because they learned from it. They put systems in place and they were ready.
Rex, maybe just a final point here this morning. Do you see any signs that the country is now turning toward public health and willing to invest more dollars there? Or is this pandemic going to come and go with really no change in that perspective?
So there is a fantastic bill in the Senate right now, a Public Health Infrastructure Saves Lives Act. And its purpose is to rebuild the public health infrastructure. You know, we can watch the Dow and the stock market move up and down every second, and yet we can't get accurate death data on a daily basis or weekly basis in this country because we haven't put the systems in place. Basically, since back in the late 70s, early 80s, we dismantled a lot of our data systems to be able to manage the health of this nation. I think there's a real opportunity to rebuild CDC and state and local health departments. And certainly people are aware of what happened because we didn't. You know, think of the trillions of dollars of impact that this has had on our national economy and the harm and suffering, not just from the deaths, but also from the stress that people have been under evictions and all kinds of other things because of less employment in certain sectors. For less than a penny on the dollar, we could have prevented almost all of that if we'd had a public health system rebuilt. So yeah, I think there's the opportunity there. And I'm glad that you asked the question, because if we don't learn from this, the folks that have died from this epidemic have really died in vain because we didn't learn the lesson.
Do you think this is going to be our last public health order, the one that the mayor just issued?
We have a hepatitis A outbreak going on right now. We have a syphilis outbreak. There will be public health orders, whether it's by the mayor or by myself or the health department. We will continue to use them when we need to. I think the scary thing in the short term is, what happens if we get a variant that is really contagious in kids and hits during the school year next fall? And we don't have vaccine to protect those kids yet. And not only are the kids getting ill, and some of them very ill, but they're also spreading it to adults again. So who knows what might happen from that perspective. But we never want to use stronger restrictions that are absolutely necessary. And so will we guess right? Will the softening of this be the right guess, or will we have to reinstitute it because it gets out of control? We'll see in the next few weeks or months.
That's Dr. Rex Archer. He's director of the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department. Rex, always appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Steve.
After a short break, we'll be back to take a look at Mother's Day coming up this weekend. We'll look at it from two very different perspectives. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Mother's Day is Sunday, and there are bound to be the traditional flowers and cards and giving mom the day off to be spoiled. We want to look at motherhood a little differently. One way is with a woman who found her identity and her full name by recreating one of her mom's favorite recipes. The other is to look at motherhood as a choice, one that more women are making in favor of being child-free. We're going to begin our conversation conversation, though, with Natalie Torres-Gallagher. She's a food writer for KC Magazine who found great meaning through one of her mother's recipes. Natalie, good morning. It's nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you.
You're a woman of mixed heritage. What's been the challenge for you that comes with being of mixed heritage?
I mean, I think for the longest time, because my mother was Tejana, she was born in Texas to Texas Tejano parents, mm-hmm. but Latin heritage. So Mexican American technically, but you know, third or fourth generation Texas, and to a white father. So I'm mixed Latina and white heritage. And I think there's just always been this sort of lifelong confusion, sort of conflated by mm-hmm. moving midway through my childhood from Texas, where I was born, to Wisconsin, to my father's hometown. So just sort of being removed from all of that Tejano culture and family there, and sort of placed very squarely in the middle of a very, wow. you know, a very white
right.
sort of environment.
You know, in college, you waited on tables and sometimes guests in your restaurant would look at you and ask, so what are you? How did you respond to that? Mm.
Always with a little bit of a laugh, you know, because
that's what you do.
As a server, you need those tips, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, usually I would explain, oh, my mother's Latina and my dad's white. You know, I have a very Irish last name, Gallagher. And I have freckles, but I'm also slightly tan, but I have big hair, but I, you know, so it was, I get, you know, and I was serving, you know, in college in Minneapolis, which is, you know, a very metropolitan city. It's very, you know, it's diverse, right. but still very Midwestern, still very predominantly white. And, I would just sort of explain, yeah, you know, I'm mixed. So yes, you know, but it was always, the phrasing of that question was always sort of
right.
awkward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell us about your parents, because your father had some Irish in him, Natalie, and how much Irish was there in your family?
Oh, my father is 75% Irish and 25% German. So his father was 100% Irish. His mother is Irish German. We grew up in a largely, or he grew up, sorry, in a largely Polish community, mm-hmm. Independence, Wisconsin, Western Wisconsin. And those traditions, he wasn't Polish, so none of those traditions were really part of my childhood, you know, my associations with my father's family. And we just never really discussed the German or the Irish. It just wasn't present, really. It was, I guess, all of the experiences, the traditions that my father's side brought to the table were really just sort of Midwestern, you know, Midwestern American. There wasn't really a lot of, you know, diverse cultural conversation going on about where we were from or that kind of thing.
Did your parents help you navigate all this identity confusion?
You know, I don't really think that it was much of a conversation point for them. My mother lived all her life in Texas until, you know, she was in her mid-30s and the family relocated to Wisconsin. So she was never sort of yanked out of her childhood, you know, she lived all her life in the same town, surrounded by, you know, people who spoke Spanish and going to markets where she could get whatever pepper she wanted. So she never had to question her identity mm-hmm. really in the way that I did. It was never confusing for her, I don't think, not in the same way, at least. And my father, no, it just never really came up, I don't think. Hmm. And my mother, you know, unfortunately, she died before I could really sort of have this conversation with her. Right. But
right.
but there were, you know, there were a few things. She she's Tejana. She was Tejana, so it was a little different, right? It's different than being born in Mexico or Mexican American. There are no family ties to Mexico whatsoever. We don't have any family there, as far as I know. You know, my great grandmother Micha was born in Victoria, Texas. She didn't speak English very well, but she was, you know, she was American. Mm-hmm. So, so my mother, you know, when I remember us taking a family trip to Mazatlan, Mexico, when, you know, I was in high school, I think, and my mother refused to speak Spanish if she didn't have to, because she wasn't confident in her Spanish.
Right.
Because she had grown up speaking both, you know, and she didn't want to, she didn't want to seem like she didn't know what she was talking about. So she was happy to just speak English.
So it was interesting that proved to be a connection for you through much of this. It was a rice recipe that helped you connect with your heritage. Tell us about that recipe and how you came across it.
Sure. It was really an oral recipe. My mother had been making this Mexican rice, and it's really like a tomato rice. It's very aromatic. It's a vegetarian dish. Usually she made it as a side dish. She wasn't adventurous in the kitchen. She didn't like, you know, she wasn't about to play around with crazy flavors. And she came from that generation where canned goods were just as good as fresh ones. So it was an easy recipe for her to make, sort of a standby weekday thing. And it was just a family favorite, and it was just her rice.
Why did it prove so powerful for you?
I think because I've never really had anything like it. You know, if you go to a Mexican restaurant, there is a Mexican rice you can get. You know, some restaurants will do it with, and it's clearly like rice cooked in tomato sauce, which is basically what she did. But she added a few extra things here and there, and you know. And I guess it's just growing up with the smell of it, the onion and the garlic and the tomato all stewing, because the scent just fills the kitchen. And it was something she made so often, and she would always, you know, she'd play music in the kitchen while she was cooking it. And then she'd make that as part of a meal for the family. You know, there would be a protein and beans and all of that. But then she would take her flour tortilla and her slice of cheese and her rice and beans and, you know, take her plate to the couch and go watch her novellas.
And when you recreated it, you write, it was really clear that you wanted to get it just right, even down to some pretty critical details. Why was it so important for you to get it just right?
Well, part of it, I think, was, you know, I'd helped her make it so often growing up. I was always in charge of chopping the vegetables, which I hated. Now I enjoy it, but that was not my favorite chore as a child. And I remember calling her, you know, when I was living away from home, when I was in college, trying to make this dish for my friends, trying to be like, this is my mother's rice. This is one of my favorite meals. This tastes like home to me. And I could just never quite get it. One time I burnt the rice. I mean, you know, it was just, and now that I'm a little more experienced in the kitchen, and I was home for the pandemic at the farm in Wisconsin, and so was my father, still lives there. My sister lives there still. And I was like, you know what, everyone's back in the kitchen. And so I just decided to get all the ingredients together. I lined them up. I put her music on. Moondance, the album by Van Morrison, was her favorite album. And I gave it a whirl. And I don't know, something clicked for the first time, maybe. And I still don't quite know how I found the magic there, but and she never wrote down the recipe. So it was really just piecing it together from
Natalie, the takeaway here is what?
Well, I think as I was considering this article, you know, and this has been sort of floating in the back of my mind for a long time, this intersection, right, of food and family and traditions and just sort of where it lines up in terms of, you know, cultural identity and what our parents, you know, how they impact that and what they leave us. And I felt like there was always a belonging for me mm-hmm. in the kitchen mm-hmm. and in this dish. And it's been 7 years, you know, since my mother died.
Right.
And the memories, sorry, just a little emotional.
Oh, but, I get it. Well,
the memories get a little, they fade a little, you know, mm-hmm. as time passes. But something about this made me feel really close to her.
Oh, that's great. That's Natalie Torres Gallagher. She's a food writer for KC Magazine. Natalie, great memory. Thanks for sharing it with us today. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Steve.
For another perspective on motherhood, we turn now to Amy Blackstone. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Maine and author of Child Free by Choice, The Movement Redefining Family and Creating a New Age of Independence. Amy chose not to have kids, a choice that's provoked a range of reactions over the years. She'll talk to us about motherhood as a choice. Amy, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Tell us about the reactions you've gotten over the years to your decision not to have kids.
Well, to be honest, they've changed over the years. Hmm. So I am now 48 years old, and I first made the rather shocking announcement to my family that I wasn't planning to have kids in my late 20s. And at that time, most of the reactions were, oh, you'll change your mind, and you're too young to make this decision, and don't you worry about who will take care of you when you're old, or you'll live to regret this choice.
Right.
And now that once I got into my 40s, the reaction has shifted to, oh, my God, you'll probably change your mind, to, oh, you poor thing. You must be so sad and lonely. And then I also get, I think, more positive response these days than I did 20 to 25 years ago. And I think that is because folks like you are opening up the conversation, and I think more people are talking openly about parenthood as a choice than they did a quarter century ago.
Why do you think people struggle so much with other folks who, you know, opt to go a different way?
Well, honestly, if you think about how we're raised, particularly how girls are raised, I mean, walk down any toy store aisle and you'll see that the girls' aisle is dedicated in many ways to preparing her for a life in the home and preparing her for a life as a mother. So girls get baby dolls. They learn how to change diapers on them. We're told our whole lives that, you know, the most fulfilling thing that we can do is become a mother. And it's so embedded, I think, in our culture that we really think of womanhood and motherhood as intertwined. They're almost one and the same. So when you come across somebody who challenges that idea, it can feel very jarring, and sometimes in a way that we can't even articulate, because it gets at this core idea that we've been raised with from, you know, the very beginning.
Can you tell us why you made the choice that you made back in your 20s and then stuck with it?
Yeah. So early on, it really was probably more a matter of delay than an outright decision. So there may have been some truth to the folks who thought I might change my mind one day, because I was thinking, you know, motherhood is not right for me right now. At the time, I was in graduate school working on my PhD, not bringing in a livable wage at all. Neither my husband nor I were particularly interested. And we thought, well, we're pretty newly married. Let's enjoy ourselves and figure out who we are as a couple. And that went on for many years. And for many years, I thought to myself, I'm too young. And then by the time I hit my mid-30s, I realized, oh, I'm probably not too young anymore, so something else is going on. And that was the point at which I really thought very deeply about it and realized I enjoy my life as it is. I appreciate the time that I have to nurture my relationship with my husband. And I heard that over and over again from other child-free people that I spoke with. And I don't feel compelled. I don't feel anything pushing me toward motherhood. And because I don't, I think it makes more sense for me to opt out. I think that all children deserve to be wanted and deserve to be raised by parents who wanted them. And I couldn't, I wasn't confident that I could offer that to a child. I had a satisfying and enjoyable life with meaning, and so decided, you know, this is the path that's right for me.
And I know it's hard for some folks to imagine, but there may be some advantages to not having kids.
Yes. I mean, I think there are certainly just as a couple of examples, I spoke with many child-free women who have careers that are very meaningful to them and who felt that if they'd opted into parenthood, they might not have been able to explore those to the extent that they did. That doesn't mean that mothers can't have, satisfying and impressive careers, but for some people, it felt like a choice and they opted, to pursue their career. I mentioned for me having the time to really nurture my connection with my husband was very important. And that is actually, if you look at the research, one of the top reasons that child-free people cite for opting out of parenthood is a desire to nurture the other relationships in their life that they already have. Certainly we have more time. So that could be a benefit.
I always find it interesting that some folks look upon women who decide not to have kids, even their husbands, the conclusion they reach is, you don't like kids. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I hear that one a lot. And fortunately, as a person who's been doing this research now for, 13 years, I can confidently say that that is not true. There are people who are child-free who, to put it in the kindest way, prefer the company of adults. And of course, why would we pressure those folks to have kids if they don't like them? But the majority of child-free people aren't in that category. In fact, in my own research of the child-free people I interviewed, 25% of them chose careers explicitly that had them involved in the lives of children. So they're teachers, social workers, pediatricians, and they wanted to make a difference in the lives of the next generation, and they opted to do that through their work rather than through parenthood. And then others of us have important relationships with nieces and nephews. I have a group of high school girls who I mentor, so many of us have children in our lives. They just don't happen to be our own children.
Another myth, you're selfish for choosing not to have kids.
Yes, even the Pope himself made that claim
really?
A few years ago, which I find really funny, as he's someone himself who has opted out of parenthood. But that's a common refrain, and I'm sort of two minds on that particular myth. On the one hand, if being selfish means that you've made a choice that feels right for you, then, okay, sure, it's a selfish choice. And we could say the same thing about folks who chose to become parents because they felt that that was the right path for them. So if we want to say that it's a selfish choice, I think we have to share that label with anyone who's made a choice about their life that feels right for them. On the other hand, if we think of selfishness about giving back, about doing for others, if you look at the way that child-free people spend their time and their money, you find, first, that we are as likely as parents to volunteer in our communities, but we're more likely to volunteer intensively. So we give more of our time, which makes sense because we have more time.
Right.
We also give a greater proportion of our money in donations. Again, for good reason, we're not spending our money rearing kids, but it's not that we're hoarding it all for ourselves.
Do women who choose not to have children, Amy, do they share certain attributes?
They do. They tend to be women in the middle and upper middle classes. This is changing, but historically, white women have been more likely to opt out of parenthood than women of color and tend to be in professional and managerial positions. We also, if you look globally, we know that when women have better access to healthcare and better access to education, that they are more likely to opt out of parenthood.
Well, that's Amy Blackstone. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Maine and author of Child Free by Choice, The Movement Redefining Family and Creating a New Age of Independence. Amy Blackstone, thanks so much for the good conversation. It's much appreciated.
Thank you.
That's it for today. You've been listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. We'll see you tomorrow.